Today's episode of The Compendium was sponsored by Critical Dice. Stick around for a special offer at the end of the show.
Welcome to The Compendium, a resource that's designed to help you spend less time learning D&D and more time actually playing.
But what you have to remember, and it says it right there on page 15 in the player's handbook, is that bonus is retroactive.
Yeah, so if a halfling was to take the lucky feat, yes, what would happen? Nothing? Or would it compound?
Chaos would ensue. There's a lot of good things, and I think looking ahead is a good idea.
All right. We are back for another episode of The Compendium. We are on episode 6, and this, I think, is our last episode talking about the foundations of character building. This episode, we're hoping to talk about leveling up your character. So basically what happens as you continue to adventure and some of the cool ways that you can build them up, buff them out, continue to shape or shift them along your adventures and your journey. But before we get into the episode, I'm really excited to tell everybody that's listening that The Compendium has actually just launched a Patreon account. Now, if you're not familiar with Patreon, it's this really great site where you can support content creators just like The Compendium by making a contribution of a small amount every month. Our lowest tier is actually going to start at just $2 a month, and you get some extra benefits or perks from being a patron to The Compendium. So if you've been benefiting from hearing these podcasts that Jason and I are creating, we would greatly appreciate your support financially with covering some of the costs that are associated with producing a podcast like this. You can find all the information you need and a link to their Patreon account by visiting our website, which is thecompendium.weebly.com. You can also get a link through our Instagram account. So anyways, long story short, we have a Patreon. We'd love for you to support us. Check it out. Now, back to what we're talking about today with character development. I'm really excited for this episode because there's just so much that you can do with characters, and there's so many ways that you can start with one character and actually by the end of their D&D adventure, you know, in the long scheme of a campaign, have them turn into a completely different character almost, just as like a character arc goes.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, and that's the thing about doing an episode about leveling up and all the options there is that as the last however many episodes have kind of testified to, that there's a lot that goes into making a character. And there's quick ways of doing it, of course, but it can be a Herculean task to get all this done. And then you play a couple of sessions and you get, yeah, I see how this is working. Yeah, this is great. And then they're like, great, time to level up. And you're like, wait, what? And then you have to learn all these other kind of like mini mechanics to do that. And I've even had people ask me on Instagram, like, hey, how does leveling up work? And I'm all, that's going to take a long time to explain. You know what? Just listen to The Compendium. We're going to do an episode on it soon. So here it is, I guess.
Yeah. So let's just start with the very basic concept of leveling up. When you are a brand new adventurer, your character starts typically at level 1. Which is basically saying, hey, you're just starting out. And as you go through an adventure, you earn, usually through combat scenarios, but not always, something called XP or your experience points. And the accumulation of those experience points are what help to move you along and kind of show that you know what you're doing a little bit more level by level, and kind of help boost you up a little bit in your knowledge, I guess.
Yeah, your knowledge and experience, just like anyone who's ever started a new job. And, you know, they got through the first week, day, or month of that job, and they're like, yeah, okay, I kind of get this. And then after they're at that job for like 5 years, 10 years, 15 years, they become just a flat-out pro, and they're training other people. And so they've leveled up in their job because they've gained experience. And so this is the same kind of thing. Yeah, as a rogue, you always knew how to be, you know, crafty and do sweet flips and pick locks, but now you're getting even better at some more things and learning how to dodge out of the way of fireballs, and you're learning how to do like trick shots and all this kind of cool stuff. So there's a lot of great things that come with that. And I think for a lot of people, for me, I know that I spend a lot of my time when I daydream about D&D. I'm spend half my time daydreaming about the adventure and half my time daydreaming about what I'm going to do when I level up. like, what's my character? Uh-huh. How am I going to like slightly shift them or change them? Or how could I have solved that previous problem once I'm now at level 6 or whatever? So mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time thinking about leveling up, and I think a lot of people do.
Yeah, I think I saw in the player's handbook, actually, I think it was on page 15. It was kind of helping to describe what some of those different level breaks look like. So generally speaking, D&D characters go from level 1 to level 20. That's what the player's handbook outlines. And have you ever gotten a character that's gotten up to level 20?
No, not through the natural order of things.
Okay.
I have played 20th level characters before, but typically I made them just to do some kind of one shot or just to see what it felt like.
Okay. Yeah. Cause my understanding is that it would take some pretty significant level of commitment to get a single character built up through campaigns to a level 20.
Yeah, it's exceedingly rare. And that just is by virtue of the best laid plans of mice and men being laid to waste, either in the game and your character dies, or out of game and, that many people just can't commit to meet on a weekly or monthly basis and show up. So, yeah.
Yeah. So when we say level 1 through 20, you're not necessarily capped at 20. You could always exceed that, but the likelihood is that 20 is kind of the tip top. By the time you get there, you'll probably be wanting to experience a new character or kind of do some other things. So the player's handbook had a great guide, I think, where it defined what some of the different levels mean as far as your knowledge as an adventurer. And it define them as level 1 through 4 apprentice adventurers. So you're facing minor threats, that are being posed to dangers, like to small villages and farmsteads and kind of local community stuff. When you get up to 5 through 10, you're facing dangers that are threatening cities or kingdoms. So you're kind of scaling how big of a problem you can solve. 11 through 16, threats to a whole regions or continents. And then once you get up to 17, 18, 19, and 20, it basically just says the existence of the entire world and multiverse.
Yeah, the fundamental order of the multiverse. Yeah, so to quote something from Critical Role, we're basically gods. It's just like, you can get up to a lot of crazy stuff at that fourth tier. So it's kind of nuts.
So what are some of the different ways that you can earn XP?
Okay, so earning experience, the most common way, as you mentioned before, is by doing battle. Combat is one of the most integral parts of D&D, along with role play and exploration. And typically when you defeat a foe, whether that's some town guards because your shopping trip went horribly wrong or horribly right, or monsters out in the wild or undead or whatever it is, you gain experience from defeating those foes. And so what's going to happen is basically the DM is going to be consulting tables in the Dungeon Master's Guide that says, hey, the challenge rating for this monster is 2, which means they're worth this many experience points. And so whenever they defeat one of these things, and you don't always have to kill it, you could drive it away, you could knock it out, you could capture it or rout it in some way, but just succeed against this creature. That's going to give them this much experience points, which is then divided by the number of people who are involved, typically the player characters. But you also could give experience points for defeating traps, enduring particularly nasty bits of terrain or environment as well. But you could also, if you uncover a plot to kill the king and avoid regicide, that would also be worth XP, even if you do it like an Agatha Christie novel and you never have to pull your sword. So there's a mm-hmm. lot of different ways of doing that. And DMs who are clever and like to keep things mixed up and not just be a hack and slash fest find new ways of doling out that experience points.
Yeah, something that I'm still kind of figuring out what my style is as a DM with shelling out XP, but something that I've realized doesn't work for my party is giving experience after every single encounter because right. my party is one so large that a lot of times I'm like, all right, you get 57 points and then one of you gets 58 because this doesn't divide evenly among all of you guys. And it just gets kind of weird. And they're tracking these kind of minuscule numbers that don't really add up very quickly. And so I've started doing like kind of, okay, I'll let you go through a couple combats and then I'll just give you a lump sum that actually is more significant. And I'll just round it up or down according to making it easier for everyone. But I've also started doing XP for puzzles. So my group loves tactile puzzles. They love like physical props that I bring to them that are kind of part of the campaign setting. And so when they solve particularly difficult puzzles, sometimes that'll be worth XP to me because they had to put their heads together to solve this problem. So there's just a wide variety of ways that you can provide XP. I think most of it isn't outside of combat. Most of it's not listed in the player's handbook. But that doesn't mean that you can't find other ways that people should get experience.
Yeah, exactly. And some of those guidelines are going to be in the Dungeon Master's Guide for sure. But a nice way to think about when should I give experience if I'm the Dungeon Master is when has your party overcome an obstacle? Just simply as that. So that's where puzzles get into there. Social interactions, mysteries, traps, and of course, combat. Did they overcome an obstacle? And you can do it that way. And what I've done in the past and people who have been my DMs over the years, they oftentimes will just give us the total at the end of that night's session. And so they'll be like, okay, hey, so tonight we're going to wrap it up right here. And everyone gets, you know, 1500 experience points. Rudy, you get an additional 150 for that amazing trap disarmament at the last second. And you get an additional 200, Scott, because of that interaction at the bar that led to that key piece of information. Great job. And then mm-hmm. you just leave it at that. So you don't have to like really nickel and dime the whole thing, you know? So that's an easy way to do it.
Yeah. And I mean, it could kind of mean different things, but there's also a way for giving out XP that's labeled, or you might hear termed milestone, which yes. is essentially, you know, like it's a specific point within the campaign. Maybe that's the end of each session. Maybe it's after you've completed the storyline, whatever it looks like, that either you dish out a lump sum of XP or you just level people up to the next level. So you don't even worry about XP. You just say, by the time you're done with this adventure, you guys all get to move from level 2 to level 3 or whatever that looks like. Yeah. So there's a lot of different ways to do that.
Absolutely. In these days, in the last several years, milestone has been almost exclusively what I've done. And the reason for that, as you kind of alluded to, is that it's much simpler. And it also, as a DM, helps me to have one less thing to keep track of. You know, there's great tables and charts that you can look up. I think there's a good one in Xanathar's Guide to Everything of, you know, how to build an encounter with, you know, this many players at this level versus this many creatures at this challenge rating and so on and so forth. And so if you do that work ahead of time, then you don't have to think about the XP. You know, okay, well, when they get to this city to uncover the plot inside the fiefdom, they should be about this level. And even a lot of the published adventures would say, at this point, they should be at about this level. Mm-hmm. And so what that does is it helps me not to have to be distracted with the numbers, but also I am thinking of their level progression the same way I'm thinking about the adventure, which is narratively driven. And mm-hmm. so I find that to be a very wonderful kind of synchronization with that, where it's like the two sides of a zipper just interlocking with each other and makes things run really, really smooth. And, you know, as they go up in level, the challenges get harder and they may not level up for 3 sessions, 4 sessions, whereas early on they were leveling up every 1 or 2 sessions. And so I think that's a really easy way to do it, especially if you're a new DM and you're overwhelmed by all of the math involved with the traditional experience point system.
Yeah. Or if you just don't want to have to deal with all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause then the players are like, hey, do we level up? No, not yet. Almost. Yeah. you can be the Wizard of Oz and stay behind the curtain.
Yeah. A couple more points on XP. One is that players each track their own XP. It's not yes. tracked by the DM for everybody. Right. And everybody has to track it separately because sometimes you don't all get the same amount of XP like you indicated. And then the other element of XP is that it's cumulative.
Yes.
So when you, let's say, you know, I don't have it right in front of me, but when you get however many XP that you need to level up from level 1 to 2, you don't reset to 0. You continue on building on that number. And so that's just something to keep in mind, is that you're always adding. You're never dropping back to 0. It's not like you're redeeming it for your level and then you get reset to nothing. So
You're not turning in tickets to the guy at the arcade.
Yeah.
But yeah, to your point, here on page 15 of the Player's Handbook, you have a handy dandy chart in the bottom right corner that says to go from level 1 to level 2, it's 300 experience points. And then from 2 to 3, it's 900 experience points. So you're basically doubling how much effort it took to get to go up a level from the previous level, and list that out all the way down there. And what's nice to know about experience points too, is it's the same progression no matter what your race class combo is. It's the same for everybody.
Yeah. And the other thing that is on that chart that we'll get to soon is going to be how it also has in that column to the far right, the proficiency bonus, because you know, that's what this whole episode is about, is the benefits of leveling up your character. It's not just, well, I can say I'm a level 3 now. There's actually some other added benefits that go on to that.
Exactly. So let's talk about what happens when someone levels up.
That a lot of stuff. So where do we even want to start that conversation? So what do you think makes sense?
Okay. So I've been thinking about this. And so what I would say, the easiest thing for a person to do when it's time for them to level up is go to the page in the Player's Handbook where it talks about what class you are. And so if I am playing a fighter, I'll go to page 71. And like all of the classes, there's going to be a handy dandy little chart there. Some are larger than others, but it lists out everything that happens, all the kind of notable differences when you go up a level. So I'm looking at the fighter chart here, and it has 1 through 20, and that tells me what the proficiency bonus is. And we talked about proficiency bonus before, but basically it's a number that gets added to a lot of different things that represents you getting better at doing whatever job it is you do in the party, whether you're a frontline fighter or a spellcaster or a healer or whatever. And this is all the same for everybody. It goes up at the same time by the same amount, no matter what class or race you're playing. And then it says features. And it says, okay, so at level 2, you get Action Surge, 1 use. And then at 3rd level, a Martial Archetype, and so on and so forth. And so all you have to do is then flip over to the page where it says, has that big heading on it for Action Surge. And you can go, oh, well, this is the new thing I get to have. And you just write down on your sheet Action Surge and remind yourself in like little, you know, shorthand what that means. And you're done. Now, if you're a spellcaster, there's a lot more to do. It's really funny. I have players who have always been spellcasters and now they're playing like rogues or fighters. And they're like, I was driving to the game and I was like, oh no, I haven't leveled up my character. And then they're like, oh yeah, I'm playing a rogue. I have one thing to write down on my sheet. No big deal. But when you get to spellcasters, what's the biggest thing that they get as they go up is they get access to more spells and more spell slots. And so I'm looking at the paladin here on 83. And as he goes up from, say, from level 4 to level 5, he gets an extra attack. His proficiency bonus goes up by 1. And he gets one more first level spell slot. And he gets his very first 2nd level spell slots. And he gets 2 of those. And so now he knows, oh, okay, well, I can, I have more spells that I can cast on a given day. And if he goes back and looks at the calculation of how he chooses how many spells he can prepare, it's probably gone up as well. And so now he has to choose a few more spells to get to prepare every single day.
And yeah, so that's, and if I was just going to say, you know, if you guys are getting a little bit confused about the spells or spell slots or some of that language, refer to episode 5. We actually do a whole episode dedicated to what spell slots are and preparing spells and all of this different lingo. So if some of that's throwing you for a loop, just refer back to some of our other content and it'll help kind of fill you in.
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't want to circle back to that too much. I'm hoping people either heard that episode or they're familiar with it, but yeah. And so that's the big, big things. Now, the other thing that people need to think about is they need to think about their hit points and their hit dice. So hit points are based mostly on a person's hit dice. So when you created your character, it told you at the very beginning, what kind of dye you use to indicate where your hit points come from. In the case of this paladin, just to stay on the same page, he uses a D10 for his hit dice. And so when he goes up from level 4 to level 5, he's going to get one more D10 to add to his pool of hit dice. And what he's going to do is he's going to roll that new die, take the result and add his constitution modifier to it, and that gets added to his hit points. So those go up as well. Hopefully he rolls high. So that's great. Now, you do need to keep track of your hit dice, because what hit dice do is that if you're taking a short rest during an adventure, that's an hour of light or no activity where you're just kind of catching your breath, you can roll any number of hit dice you want up to your maximum, in this case 5, and take the result plus your constitution and gain back that many hit points while you rest. And so this is an easy non-magical way of getting back hit points and some other things during a short rest so that you can continue on into the dungeon, the castle, the keep, the forest to hopefully attain your goal without having to camp down for the night and kind of reset with a long rest. And so that's what those hit dice are there for.
Yeah. And like you said, you get an additional hit die for every level that you increase. So if you're a level 5, you should have 5 hit dice in your repertoire. If you're a level 20, you should have 20 hit dice. So that's an easy thing. You just get one extra one there. And then, like you said, for the HP, you take a single one of those dice. Unfortunately, you don't get to roll all of the hit dice that you've accumulated. And then you roll that every single time you level up. So there's certain leveling up traits that you only get here and there, depending on what level you get to. But this is something that happens no matter what your class is, no matter what your level is. This is going to happen continuously every single time you get leveled up.
Right. And that rolling that new hit die, that number is being added to your maximum hit point value. Okay. So that raises the ceiling of how many hit points you can have. But when you spend them during a short rest, that's regaining missing hit points up to that new maximum. And you only have so many to use. And so if you take 2 short rests during an adventure and you spent 2 hit dice in the first one and 3 hit dice in the third one, you're out of hit dice. And now you're going to have to rely on magical healing, or you're going to have to rely on finding a safe place to have a long rest where you can gain back all of your hit points. And you actually only gain back half of your maximum hit dice to spend per long rest.
I mean, my players a little bit disappointed when I told them of that caveat in the player's handbook. And they're like, wait, what? I was like, yeah, you only get half of them back, guys. Sorry.
Yeah. You can get worn down pretty easily if you're not careful. So
yeah.
Until you get to Rivendell and take a long rest for a couple of weeks with the elves, you gotta, you know, watch this hit die.
Some other things that happen when you level up, but not consistently, is something that can change is your proficiency bonus. So your proficiency bonus can increase depending on the level you're at. So there is a chart for this on page 15 of the player's handbook, but it's a +2 when you start, and that's going to be +2 from levels 1 to 4. But once you hit level 5, you get to go up to a +3. And then that kind of carries for a period of time until eventually the highest you can get to your proficiency is a +6. So that's one of those ones that's not necessarily every time you level, but you want to check what level that you're going to see if you've kind of bridged that place that you can get that.
Right. And just to remind you why that proficiency bonus is so important, we talked about it during that episode, but that's going to get added to all of your ranged and melee attacks. It's going to get added to all of the skills that you have proficiency in. It's going to be added to your spell DC modifier. It's going to get added to your spell attack modifier. It's added to a lot of things. And so it's going to make a big overall improvement to a lot of things in your character. So it's huge.
Yeah. What are some of the other things that happen when you get leveled up? Is it class based that sometimes your speed can get influenced?
Yeah. Typically your speed doesn't change on a level up. The monk is a notable exception to this. Part of their class feature is that they get faster and faster as they go up. They actually get huge bonuses to their speed. I'm looking it up right now. Speed increases by 10, 2 through 5th level. And then when they get to 6th level, it increases by 15. it increases by 20 at level 10, increases by 25 at level 14, and increases by 30 starting at level 18. So if you're a typical humanoid, your speed is basically doubled once you get to level 18.
That's insane.
It's absolutely insane. And not to mention that they can spend a key point and take the dash action as a bonus action, which means they get double their speed and still get to attack. And they can just be the Flash, basically, which is fun.
Yeah. Okay. So a lot of those other traits that can be influenced, those are going to be class specific. Are there any race specific leveling up? There's not, right?
There is actually. So there are a couple of races that have innate magic. The Tiefling is the first one that comes to mind for this. And they have a couple of innate magical abilities. I'm trying to pull them up real quick. We're basically at level one, they know this certain cantrip. And then at level three, they gain something called Hellish Rebuke. And then at level five, they gain some more things. Drow magic is also one. So a race of the elves, the Drow, they know the Dancing Light cantrip when they just at first level. When they reach third level, they can now cast Fairy Fire once per day. And then when you reach fifth level, you can also cast the Darkness spell once per day. And Charisma is the spell casting ability there. And the Tiefling has something similar, if I could just get to it quickly enough. And so that's an example of where there would be a race-specific thing to leveling up.
Okay, yeah. So basically, every time that you're about to hit a new level, you need to check both the race and the class to see what benefits that you get.
Right, and the race one is a bit more uncommon than the others, but typically you're gonna know about that when you made the character because you were like, oh, cool, I get the Thaumaturgy cantrip as a Tiefling, cool. And then at third level, you get more stuff. But again, if you're using a tool like D&D Beyond, it'll do that automatically for you.
Okay, I did have a clarifying question about like hit dice, kind of, you know, all within the same realm of what we're talking about. On most of the class pages, right now I'm looking at the Barbarian just for reference, but on most of them, they have hit points at first level. And then like this one is 12 plus your constitution. So you get a D12 plus your constitution. But on higher levels, it says 1D12. And in parentheses, it says or 7 plus your constitution. Is that like you can do one or the other? It's kind of like the point buy within the class. So you pick the 7, or is it more of the, it's at least 7. So if you roll a 2, it's 7, like the bottom you can get is a 7. Like how does that work?
Right. So at first level, it's just your max on the die plus your con. Consecutive levels, you're going to roll that die and then add your constitution. But you can also choose instead of that, if you happen to be a legendary terrible dice roller, you can take that number in parentheses because that represents the statistical average of the die roll. And you can just take average. And that way you avoid any low rolls, but it also means you avoid any really high rolls. So it's not a minimum. It's just a alternate option that you can choose beforehand. You can't roll one and then choose the other, that you can kind of take the safe path and have a good hit point value no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
So there is one more thing of significant note that I think we should talk about when it comes to leveling up, and that is the ability score increase.
Okay.
And so this actually leads into another thing called feats that we'll talk about in a second. But the ability score increase is interesting because every class does it at a different rate. But I think all of them get their very first one at level 4. Fighters get one like every other level, which is ridiculous. And like the, you know, wizard, I think, gets them, you know, much more spaced out. But what that is basically when you hit that level, it'll say it right there in that block of text that we talked about in that chart, you have ability score increase. That means you could improve one ability by one, or two abilities by one, or one ability by two. Okay.
Yeah.
And so if you had a intelligence of 16 and you wanted to put both of those improvements into intelligence, it would now be 18. What's cool about that is going back to our calculus from before, now that your ability score is 18, that means your bonus is no longer 3, it's now 4. and that get applied to a lot of things like your skills and your spell attack bonus and your DC number and all that stuff if you're, say, a wizard. Mm-hmm. So that's really great way to do that as well. There is another thing that people can do too that has a really kind of not well known bonus, is that if you choose to put your points into constitution, and it's enough that your constitution bumps up and so you get another plus to it, of course, that's going to affect your hit points, right? So if mm-hmm. you went from a plus two to a plus three at this level bump, you're like, great, I'm going to roll my d12. I'm going to add now plus three from my constitution instead of plus two. Now I have more hit points. Great. But what you have to remember, and it says it right there on page 15 in the player's handbook, is that bonus is retroactive. So if you're level eight, you don't just get an extra one to your hit points, you get an extra eight to your hit points when that happened. Okay. So it's a plus one to all of the levels that you have. So it works backwards like that. And constitution is unique in that way because it represents your experience plus your physicality to give mm-hmm. you an even more significant bump to your hit points.
No, that's a really good point. I feel like I've heard that once before, but I didn't remember that mechanic and that like caveat of trickery.
Yeah. Yeah. Knowing this rule could save your life. Well, your character's life. So yeah, so that's the ability score increase, which is really really important. Now, we can also talk about an optional rule that's in the player's handbook that gives you something else that you could do instead of your ability score increase, which is called feats. Feats are super cool. I love feats. You don't have to use them. As a DM, you're just like, I don't understand this. It gets kind of wild. It makes too much chaos. I don't want to do this. It's fine. It's listed as an optional rule, but almost every table I've ever been at, they've been totally fine with feats. Mm-hmm. I think many people at this point have forgotten it's an optional rule, and that's okay. But what a feat is it is something that is represented beyond what comes with your race or your class. This is something that you as an individual are particularly good at, something that maybe has come up in the narrative of the story or a direction you want to take your character, and is something that just kind of helps you make your character unique and make it make you, as it were. And you can find all these on page 165 of the player's handbook. And what it does is, instead of taking that ability score bump as you want to apply it, you forego that and instead choose one of the feats listed in a source book, the player's handbook, Xanathar's Guide to Everything, and others. And there's two caveats with this. One, some of them have a prerequisite. So there's a feat here early on that's called Defensive Duelist, and the prerequisite is your dexterity has to be 13 or higher. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that you can't pick the same feat more than once unless it specifically says so in the description. And the only one that I'm aware of right now is the Magic Initiate, I think it is, that does that. Everything else, it's like you pick this and now you have to kind of move on. You can't pick this again and like really bump something up to a ridiculous level.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so, something else too, once you have selected that feat, you use the Defensive Duelist as an example. Things that do have that prerequisite, if for some reason your character loses that prerequisite, so on this one it's a dexterity of 13 or higher, if you get cursed or if something happens to you and your dex score drops below 13, that feat is temporarily suspended. And so you don't lose it for good, but you can't use it again until you get your dexterity or whatever that prerequisite is back up.
Yeah, exactly. And I misspoke. It's not the feat I said, it's the Elemental Adept is the only one you can take more than once, as of this recording, at least. Elemental Adept, my bad. And so what are these feats? So these feats are almost like these new class abilities or character abilities, or like almost like almost on, always on abilities that you can choose. And they can do a wide variety of things. There's some that'll permanently boost your initiative, and make it so that you can never be surprised as long as you're awake. There's some that make you super good at shooting crossbows. There's others that let you dual wield melee weapons and get additional bonuses. There's some that can give you proficiency with weapons that you aren't proficient with yet. There's some that can give you proficiency with certain skills that you weren't previously proficient with. With new languages, you can get proficiency with new types of armor, which is amazing. You could use one of these feats to have a wizard who's wearing, you know, hide armor and can still cast spells just fine, which is phenomenal. I love mixing and matching these kind of wild things. And so I was going to kind of just like go through a couple of my favorite ones that I get picked a whole lot. I mentioned already dual wielder because it's great for the action economy. It lets you basically do more things when you're holding two weapons in your hand, in either hand. It gives you a plus one bonus to AC while you're wielding two different melee weapons in each hand. You can use two weapon fighting, even though both of the weapons aren't light, which is one of the previous restrictions, and you can draw both of them at the same time just as fast as you could draw one. So it's really cool and can make you a lot more powerful. Another one is the lucky feat. Basically, lucky gives you three luck points, and whenever you make an attack roll, an ability check, or a saving throw, basically just about any time you do a d20 roll, you can spend a luck point and roll an extra d20. And then you can choose which of the dice you want to use. You also can wait until the first die is rolled and go, oh, that's bad, I'm going to use luck, and roll that, and then you pick the one you want to use. You could also spend one to do it to somebody else. So if a bad guy is like, oh, he got a crit, lucky, he has to re-roll that. And they're like, ah, dang it. Okay, he rolled a 7 this time. He missed completely. But when your three luck points are out, you are out of luck and you don't get them back until you finish a long rest.
So I have a very niche question about lucky.
Please.
Halflings.
Yes.
They have a special trait that is, what is it called?
It's not called lucky, but it's like basically they're naturally lucky.
Yeah. So if a halfling was to take the lucky feat, yes, what would happen? Nothing? Or would it compound?
Chaos would ensue. What their ability is called it's called lucky. Oh, awesome. Great. Thanks, Wizards of the Coast, for making that not confusing at all. So what their ability says is that when you roll a 1 on an attack roll, ability check, or saving throw, so the same requirements as before, you can re-roll the die and must use the new die roll, okay? So the trigger here for the racial ability is that you rolled a 1 on a d20 roll. Mm-hmm. And then it kicks in and you can re-roll the die and you have to use the new roll, even if it's a 1 already.
Yeah.
Okay. But if you roll a 1 again, lucky doesn't kick in again. It's already happened on this instance. But if you had the lucky feat, you could go, you know what? I'm going to try that again and use a luck point, and you can roll another one. So you could conceivably have three chances not to get a 1 on a particular attack roll or ability.
And if you still get a 1 by then, you really need to rethink your life.
You really need to rethink your life, or you need to be playing a wizard who has taken the path of the school of divination, because the divination power, what it lets you do is at the beginning of every day, every long rest, you roll 2d20s and you set those numbers aside. And at any time you can replace a d20 roll from an ability check or saving throw and then replace it with that. And you could do it to you or to another person. And so the desire for me to play a lucky halfling divination wizard is strong because I just can't wait to roll like 5d20s to, you know, try to avoid.
No, I will hit you.
Yeah, no, this is happening.
Okay, so, sorry.
And just to give credit where credit is due, Z Bashu, who does the animated spellbook on YouTube, which is excellent. You should totally check it out. He is the first person that I've seen, at least, who put forward that exact combination with that exact ridiculousness. And he even did the math to figure out how hard it would be to actually roll a 1 that would stick. And it's I don't have the math in front of me, but it's ridiculous.
That's awesome. All right. So what are some of your other favorite feats that you've got here?
Okay. There's one called, I think it's called is it magical something? What is it? Magic Initiate. And what that does, basically you get to choose a class that has a natural spellcasting ability like Bard, Cleric, Druid, Sorcerer, Warlock, or Wizard. And you just learn two cantrips of your choice from that class's spell list. And you also can pick one first level spell from them, that same list, and you learn that. You don't have to have spell slots. You just get to cast that first level spell once a day until you finish a long rest. And then you just have those cantrips. And the spell casting ability that's tied to is whatever it would be for that original class. Okay. And so it's like you were born to be a bard, but you just never went to college. And so you have that natural affinity, but you weren't a full on bard, or you were, you know, mm-hmm. you thought about becoming a cleric and, you know, worshiping Paylor, but you know, life got in the way. Dad needed help at the auto body shop, but you know, I can still cast Spare the Dying.
It's like Harry Potter if he never got the letter from the owl.
Exactly. Man, Harry
weird
Potter
stuff
again.
Just keeps happening to me.
I know, it's so odd. It's super weird. And I guess I have the lucky feet. I don't know. Anyway, so yeah, so that's one of my favorites. I love doing that because it mixes things up and again gives the versatility to things. Some of the other ones that are people really, really like are also Sharpshooter, which is really fun. And Great Weapon Master. Sharpshooter, what that does is that you've mastered range weapons and you can take shots that other people find impossible. Basically, it lets you be a sniper, okay? So we've talked before how range weapons have the short range and the long range.
Mm-hmm.
And like a longbow has a long range of like 600 feet, but anything in that, you know, long range is going to be a disadvantage. If you have this feat, you don't count that. You can just shoot up to 600 feet away with no disadvantage whatsoever. And if someone's hiding behind a barrel or behind a rock, they have like half or three quarters cover, you can ignore that too. If like their hand is sticking out, you can still hit it from 600 feet away. And then if you choose to, before you roll, you can choose to take a -5 to the attack roll to gain a +10 to the damage.
What?
Yeah. So before you make the attack, you can go, I'm going to use Sharpshooter on this. And you could like lay down, find that goblin who has like one ear poking out from behind a rock at 600 feet away and just peg him for like crazy damage and drop him. And people are like, what is wrong with you? How do you, you know, so.
See, that's where you take the lucky feat and that feat. So you can take the penalty, but you can almost always still hit.
Yes.
I'm liking it.
Yeah, and drive dungeon masters crazy everywhere. And so Great Weapon Master is another one that's kind of like that, where you learn to really just go nuts with your weapons. And so basically, when you score a critical hit with the melee weapon, or you reduce a creature to 0 hit points with a critical hit, you get to roll, you get to do an extra melee attack as a bonus action to another target, presumably. And then also too, before you make the roll, you can call the shot and say, hey, I'm going to use Great Weapon Master and take a -5 to the attack roll, but get a +10 to the attack damage.
Wow. Yeah. Some of these are great. And you said the fighter can just level these up like every other level or something ridiculous or opt for these?
Something like that. Yeah. The fighter gets an ability score increase and therefore the option to do a feat if the DM allows it. He gets a chance to do it at 4th level, 6th level, 8th level, 12th level, 14th level, 16th level, and 19th level. So wow. A lot. It seems like it's all the time. So yeah, there's a lot going on there. And so feats can be a lot of fun. You just got to remember how they work and remember that you have it to really even further customize your character. And what's really great too, and I think this is important, is anyone can pick these as long as you meet the requirements. But I think it's especially powerful from a game-telling perspective when you choose one of these based on things that have been happening in the game. That mm-hmm. if you've been doing a lot of arrow attacks and you've been really being that kind of backline ranged attacker, and then you've picked Sharpshooter, perfect. That makes a lot of sense. Or if you've been doing a lot of like disguise self stuff around and trying to be sneaky and pretending you have a different name in every town and you know the cops are always looking for you, picking the actor feat would be really great towards that and make a lot of narrative sense. where it basically lets you have an increase in your charisma. You gain perception advantage on deception and performance checks, and you can mimic the speech of other people as long as you've heard them for at least a minute talking. Mm-hmm. So if you need to infiltrate the Duke's court, you know, celebration, and pretend to be one of the courtiers that you have locked up back at the base, you can do that now.
Yeah, I really love story-driven character development. Obviously, yeah, it's up to the player and the DM on what they want to do. And you could metagame and just pick whatever is the cool mm-hmm. one or what's going to beef you up. Or like we were talking about, ooh, you could layer these to make something yeah. really great. But I actually feel like the story-driven ones are the ones that are just more valuable. So yeah, that's always my preference and how I always urge my players to go.
Yeah, exactly. Because it just makes for a more powerful narrative, a more powerful story. And that's one of the main goals of D&D is to tell great stories together. The last thing I'll say about this and give our listeners a little homework. If you've never looked at the Polearm Master feat and then also read the Sentinel feat, you might want to do that and just dream up some really terrible ways you can make your dungeon master's life miserable. I won't spill the beans here, but just go ahead and read those and dream up some cool combos.
So while we're talking about kind of adding some variety to your character through, you know, some of these different avenues that we've discussed so far, something that I want to talk about, and I don't know if there's an official term for it, but how, depending on, you know, certain levels, usually level 3 is when it starts, different classes can select colleges or paths. They're all named different things, so that's why I don't know what to call them. Is there a term for these things?
Yes, they're called subclasses.
Oh, really? But it's just, okay, that seems like a confusing...
Right. So it is a term. Specific, it's a path inside of your class. And so it's a subset. So it's a subclass. That's the idea. In previous versions, they called them paragon paths and things like this. But it's basically a specialization you can take inside of being a wizard or a rogue or a ranger. And everybody has them. And you're right, most of them get them at level 3. There's a few exceptions. I think the cleric gets it earlier, and I think also that the wizard gets it earlier. I'm looking it up right now. Arcane Tradition is what it's called for the wizard, and they get that at level 2. And then for the cleric, I think they do theirs right away. I could be wrong. Let me look. They get theirs at level 1, their divine domain.
The fighter gets a action surge at level 2. So there's a couple of them that start sooner than
the fighter
level 3.
The fighter picks his at level 3, actually. He has an archetype. They have a divine domain. Others have schools, colleges, paths, patrons, that packs, that kind of thing. So it changes it for every one of them, most of them are at level 3, and there's a few other small cases where it's like a level 2 or level 1. But basically this lets you go down a very specific path for your class. And so, for example, with a wizard, you're choosing which school of magic you want to specialize in. You're declaring your major, as it were. Do you want to go into evocation, which is all like the damaging spells? Do you want to go into conjuration and be able to make vaguely magical, temporary, mundane items at will? Do you want to go into divination, like I mentioned before, and kind of have limited access to see the future and roll those 2d20? And various other things. Rogues, it's really cool. They can become more like assassins. They can be more like thieves. They even have one where they can become like arcane archers and arcane trickster, and have a little bit of access to magic. The fighter can be a battle master where they get to learn these really sweet moves with their sword, kind of like Inigo Montoya and the Man in Black and Princess Bride.
Prepare to die.
That's right. I see you study Agrippa. Or they could pick something like Eldritch Knight, and now they have limited access to wizard spells, even though they're still a fighter and a big beefy boy. Check those out, and you'll always see something in your progression chart, the beginning of your class, like martial archetype or divine domain feature. And you'll just need to go back to the one you chose and find in that paragraph what happens at level six as it references that. So that that's just going to point you back to that specific part of your character. So you'll know what you need to add based on what you chose.
Yeah. And I mean, there's just so many of those, we would never be able to cover all of them, but that's just kind of where you just need to familiarize, you know, yourselves individually with what you're pursuing. And I think it helps too, because I even had one character that kind of looked ahead at some of those different options as things progressed, and it helped shape the foundation of his character, because it helped him hone in on what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it and the kind of person that he thought he was. And it helped guide some of his, you know, character building decisions, knowing what he could kind of naturally flow into. So being familiar with all that is really helpful.
Yeah, exactly. And it's good to have goals. It's good to have a plan. You know, this is your character's 5-year plan. Like, yeah, I'm going to be the best swordsman in the whole realm, or yeah, I'm going to be friend to all the beasts, you know, as a ranger or whatever. And so there's a lot of good things. And I think looking ahead is a good idea. It helps you, like you said, solidify where you're going and what your goals are.
Yeah. So outside of your subclasses, there is also an additional way that you can that you can add some spice to your character's life, I guess you could say. And we have been teasing it in many episodes because it's a very popular option, which is multi-classing.
Maybe we should just wait until next week to do multi-classing.
Yeah, I'm just kidding. Hold it. A teaser again.
I'm kidding. Okay, so multi-classing is the other big optional rule along with feats. In fact, they're both in Chapter 6 of the Player's Handbook. They were kind of put together, which is really smart. So multi-classing is basically a chance for you to change directions, to take a hard right turn for your character's narrative and choose to be something else. And so let's say that you have been a fighter this whole time and you're about to level up to level 5 and you go, you know what? I'm going to change my mind. I want to be a barbarian now, which would make sense because you've been like, you know, yelling and screaming as you go into battle and you're just like, rah. And you're like, yeah, I feel like he's kind of being more like, you know, in touch with his emotions and rage. He's a very emotional fighter. Let's go that direction. Great. So what that means is that when you go up to level 5, what you're doing instead is you're choosing to be a level 4 fighter, all the previous experience, plus now you're also a level 1 barbarian.
Making you a level 5 character.
Exactly. Which we have teased before because we had to explain that. But yeah, so your overall character level is the combination of all of the classes you have. Even if all the classes you have is just one, that's fine. So what happens is that you don't lose any of the previous stuff that you did. You just now are gaining some additional abilities and features by adding another class into your character's portfolio, as it were. Mm-hmm. So what happens here is that one, there are multi-classing prerequisites. And there's a little chart there at the beginning of Chapter 6 that tells you, you know, to be a barbarian, you have to have at least a strength of 13. To be a wizard, you have to have an intelligence of 13 and so on. And as long as you meet that requirement and your DM is cool with this, then you can go ahead and pick a new class. Now, there's a couple other kind of things that get a little complicated when it comes to experience points. Again, you default back to your character level to figure out how much XP you need to go to the next level. So you're still on the same progression chart, even though you've chosen to mix it up and have two different classes you're playing.
Yeah. So for like example, if you were a level 3 fighter and you were wanting to go to barbarian, you wouldn't need that first kind of level jump is 300 XP. You wouldn't just need 300 XP to go into a barbarian because you're going into a level 1 barbarian. You would need enough XP to level up to your next level. So it's not necessarily, you don't do them side by side. It continues to be cumulative.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a great way to put it. And then when it comes to hit points and hit dice, when you take that, for using our example, that fifth level and you chose to make it barbarian, that level, you're going to roll the D12 for your hit dice. But now you've got some hit dice that are D12s and some hit dice that are D10s. You need to keep them separated, like the song says, and know which ones you're rolling when you take a short rest to gain back hit points and stuff. But a lot of times, like say a paladin and a fighter, they both use D10. Don't worry about it. They're all the same. They mix in all together, all fun. And so then, yeah.
With the hit dice, what would you do when you are doing your HP roll? If you have two different dice, which one would you roll?
When you're trying to gain back hit points during a short rest, or when you're gaining
when you're leveling up?
When you're leveling up, whatever the hit die is for the character, for the class you're now choosing.
Okay.
Right. So if at level 5, you're like, you know what? I'm not going to go the fighter path. I'm going to go to barbarian. For that level, you would roll the barbarian hit dice.
Okay.
Yeah. And then again, proficiency bonus also based on your class, on your character level, not your class level. So you still progress the same speed as everybody else, even though you've diversified. And now here's the cool thing is that with multiclassing, when I gain that level in barbarian, I don't get everything that I get when I become a level 1 barbarian starting from scratch. I only get some things from this new class. And there's a chart on the next page that tells you exactly what you get. You gain, like for barbarians, you gain proficiencies to shield, simple weapons, and martial weapons, which is, you know, if you're coming from fighter, big deal. But hey, if you came, you're coming from rogue, that's way different. You get a lot of really cool things. Then it gives you the whole thing there. Now, it also gives you access to everything else you get at level 1. And so if barbarians have access to rage at level 1, guess what? You can now rage. If you have access to, you know, 3 cantrips and 2 first level spells, you gain access to those things as well. It just proficiencies are pared down a little bit when you take the multi-class option to gain this new class.
Yeah, and it specifies them on page 164, right in that same section we are, but there are a couple of caveats to that where there's a few things that if your character already possesses it, you don't get it again. So one of them is an extra attack. If your class already gives you an extra attack, you don't get an extra attack.
Right.
It just kind of
XL. Yeah.
Yeah. It just kind of gets nullified. So it's just a couple. I think it's only like 3 of them that are in there that have those caveats, but just take a look at that too.
Exactly. Yeah. Like channel divinity, extra attack. It all leaves it out there. Now here's where it gets really kind of wild with multiclassing is when it comes to spell slots.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
I know this, and I have it open here in front of me, and that's good because as much as I've played this game, this one I always have to go back and look at every time I multi-class, which I do a lot because, as we've established, I like versatility. So what happens is that the nice thing is that you don't have to keep your spell slots separate. Okay? So if you say you were a wizard and then you became a sorcerer, and you already have your whole, you know, spell slot table from your wizard class, you have all of those, and then you also gain additional spell slots from the sorcerer at first level. So that's fine. And you gain the new spells and things, and you can use any of the spell slots you have for your sorcerer spells or for your wizard spells. You don't have to, you know, determine which ones are for who, which is really nice because now you have access to cast a ton of new magic. Where it gets weird is when you have these classes that are not full caster classes. Okay. So basically it's this, is that you determine what spells you know and can prepare for each class individually. And so if you're a 4th level ranger and a 3rd level wizard, then great. You know your 1st level ranger spells and you know your 3rd level wizard spells. But where it gets weird is this, is with the spell slots. When you have these half casters, okay? So a bard, a cleric, a druid, a sorcerer, and a wizard, they're all full casters. Their primary way of adventuring is with spells. But things like the paladin and the ranger, those are considered like half spell casting classes. They have a lot of martial ability and only kind of rely on their spells. And interestingly enough, paladins and rangers, they don't get access to cantrips. So in those cases, you only get half of the spell slots available to those classes when you add them as a multi-class, right? So if the paladin only has two first level spell slots at that level, you would only get one spell slot. And then it gets even further weird if that you've done a fighter who's an Eldritch Knight or a rogue who's an arcane trickster, both martial subclasses that get spell casting, there it's a third rounded down
for that. Of course there is.
Right. So that's where it gets really tricky. And so maybe just don't multi-class into those things.
That's the easiest solution. If you don't like math, well, one, yeah. If you don't like math, you shouldn't be playing this game.
I challenge that. No, come on. But yeah, maybe just be strategic about it or just let something like D&D Beyond do it for you, for heaven's sakes, please, for the love of Paylor. That's what you do. And also think about it too, like, you know, where you want to start. If you know you want to multi-class because you have this cool combo in your head that you want to do, think about which class is going to give you the most oomph by starting out at first level, because you only get minimized things like spell slots and proficiencies when you add that second class or third class at when you multi-class. So just kind of think about where you want to start and what's the best way to do that. Just kind of look at that and be careful when it comes to your spell slots with those half and third casters.
So is this the class that you start with, is that always your primary class?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So even if you have one level of, let's say, Bard, and then you take a weird 180 and you're like, I'm going to be a fighter, and you just, for the rest of the campaign, you level up your fighter and you have a level 1 Bard and a level 19 fighter, your primary class is still going to be Bard?
Yes, because remember, the next time you take a new level, you could choose just to go back to Bard.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's my understanding of it, at least. I mean, there might be some people who are like, no, now that you've gone back to Bard and taken another level there, it's like you're multi-classing back to Bard, but I don't think that's how it should be. So yeah, that is kind of, think of it as your main and then secondary classes.
Okay. And then, yeah, so that would, I was curious if any of those kind of like nuances would shift if your primary was like a full casting or a not, or some of those different spell slots or something, if that would shift and then kind of change that whole equation again. But it sounds like that at least stays consistent.
Right. And it does. And then also to help you out with this multi-class spellcaster thing, come back and look at this chart also here on 165 that kind of gives you the progression of how that works, where it's the multi-class spellcaster chart, spell slots per spell level.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Multi-classing. Yeah. It's so fun, but so complicated.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. And I'm not absolutely 100% sure I didn't just mangle it in my description, but I will say this with a giant asterisk. Just go read that section, please. And before you send us the evil email saying that I got it wrong, because maybe I did. We'll see.
Well, there's just so many combinations. Like, it's, you know, it's limitless basically as to what you could build or how, and like all of how it comes together just changes based off of what you pick. So
yeah, exactly.
All right. So that is XP, your stat increases, feats that you can take at different levels, subclasses that you can take, and multiclassing, which is kind of the holistic look at leveling up, kind of. I think it's a good round, I don't know, collection of information. Are we missing anything in there?
I'm sure we are, but I can't think of what it could be right now. So again, like with everything, if this is overwhelming to you, find your nearest nerd, have them help you out, or just play a human fighter and you'll be fine.
So that, this seems a little weird. That wraps up our discussion about character building.
Yeah, it only took us like an hour to do it.
Right? That, you know, just like that, we wrapped up. And so when we come back for our next episode, episode 7, we actually get to get our hands dirty a little bit into gameplay.
Okay,
that's I'm so excited.
Great. Yeah, and that, and also let me say the caveat on that. A lot of that's going to be like game theory. It's going to be the general overview, but also a lot of our personal feelings about it, because these aren't numbers and rules where we can go back and reference and say, "See, extra attack works like this." This is a lot of kind of just ways that you can make things run better by having a basic understanding of what your job is and the what the relationship should be like around the table. And so it's going to be good.
Yeah, I love the fact that at this point we've completely equipped people to have this really solid understanding of their character, but they yet have no idea what to do with it.
Yeah.
I'm kind of just like prepared, but there's nowhere for them to go.
Yeah, so
we're going to give you somewhere to go next time.
Yeah, guys. We're going to go on an adventure, you guys. Let's do this.
All right. Thank you guys so much for tuning into the Compendium. And we are looking forward to continuing our discussion about D&D next week.
See you next time.
Thanks for listening into the Compendium. This particular episode was sponsored by The Critical Dice and The Endless Bag of Dice. If you are a dice lover like me, this is an awesome service because you can actually get a brand new set of dice delivered directly to your doorstep every single month for as low as $6.99. Compendium listeners can actually get a special offer by using the code Compendium, that's C-O-M-P-E-N-D-M, at checkout for their Endless Bag of Dice for 50% off that first month of dice. That's seriously dice as low as like $3. Just go to thecriticaldice.com and use the code Compendium at checkout. We hope that you guys enjoyed listening in this week. If you haven't already, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. Jason and I really enjoy creating this content, and it definitely helps boost our charisma modifier every time we see a 5-star rating pop up. The Compendium is also on Patreon, so if you like listening, that is a great way to contribute to the content that we create. New episodes are available every Tuesday and Friday, or if you're a patron, you get them a day early, so Mondays and Thursdays. And you can always keep up with us between episodes by following us on social media. We're on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. Just look us up by searching for The Compendium. Thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next time.